and welcome to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange Ask the Expert session. Today's topic is WebSphere plugin configuration, including properties, admin console, SSL, load balancing, and failover. My name is Kathy Kuhn, and this session will give you the opportunity to speak to a panel of experts on a variety of subjects related to today's topic. Moving on to slide number 2. In today's session, we will start off by introducing our panel of experts to you. Then we will move on to a brief introduction of our subject title. Next, our panel of experts will answer questions that they submitted and the ones that were submitted by our customers. Then we will open the lines for the live Q&A period. And finally, the session will end with a summary of today's session. Slide number 3. At this time, I'd like to pass control over to Bob to begin the introduction of our panel of experts. Bob?
Thank you, Kathy. My name is Bob Richter, and I'll introduce myself, and then I'll turn it over to Harold. I've worked in WebSphere for the WebSphere Level 2 for the last 6 years, and prior to that, prior to the support in Level 2, I worked in WebSphere development a long time ago in the VM operating system support, a short period in VTAM development, NetView development, PCOM development, and more recently, IBM HTTP Server development. So with that, I'll turn it over to Harold.
Okay. Thanks, Bob. My name's Harold Fanning. I'm also a Level 2 support engineer. I started my career as a Level 2 support engineer on a operating system called DPPX back in the day, where it was sort of an SNA satellite machine to the mainframe. And that led me into a development career with communication servers and the SNA architecture for the COM servers on both OS2 and NT. And then I went back into support and started working on support for PCOM, because PCOM had that SNA interface. And then I supported a product that was called Host Access Translation, or HATS, which was, for lack of better terms, a way to webify some of those legacy 3270 and 5250 applications. And from there, that led me into the WebSphere brand, first supporting the application support tool, and then finally where I am now with the IHS web servers, the plug-in, and the edge products like the load balancer and the caching proxy. So with that introduction, we can move to slide 4. Okay, and this is slide 4 is the introduction of what we plan to cover today. We'll be covering a number of questions, and they're not all, they're sort of covering what we already knew about that might be asked, as well as some questions that were pre-submitted to us, and they seem to have a lot of concern with things like the plugin properties, some of the configuration of those properties. We had a couple of SSL questions, and then Bob and I both work on the WebSphere App Server Distributed Platform team, so the WASD team. So this will just be on those distributed platforms. So first we'll go to some of the submitted questions. If you go ahead and go to slide 5. First question we were asked was, how do you set up SSL between the WebSphere plugin and the App Server? Now, I wanted to premise this question by first understanding, and we do have a good tech share that talks about setting up SSL, what I call soup to nuts, or from the client all the way up to the back-end app server. And to understand that, you have to realize there's actually a two-step SSL configuration. One would be between the client and the IHS web server, and the second one is between the plugin and the WAS. So this question here is that second piece from the plugin up to the WAS, where WAS is the SSL server. So in an SSL handshake, it's always the client that comes in and asks for the request, and it's the SSL server that has to send down that personal certificate. So the personal certificate has to then be verified by the client to say, yes, I trust I'm going to where I think I'm going. So in that case, what I'm trying to present before I go to the next screen is that it's the plugin that has to know about the signer certificates from the app server side, and those have to be then in the plugin's key.kdb so that he can verify the plug-in, and that's what this question is geared towards. So it's geared towards that second part of the configuration. So we can go to slide six. So because the plug-in is the client and the WAS is the server, the WAS is the one that's sending that certificate. The plug-in key.kdb has to have those signer certificates. So this screen here is saying what you do is you have to go to that admin console. So you go over to the WAS side and actually go into his key store and find his personal certificate. And from that personal certificate, you want to find out who signed it. Or who. There might be more than one signer, too. There may be an intermediate. There may be a root. And you have to make sure that you pull and extract those certificates. So you want to first know which personal certificate you want to use, and then you want to make sure that you have the entire chain of signer certificates from the trust store of that certificate. And, again, be paying attention that you pick up all the intermediates and the roots and all that. And then when you want to extract those, you'll move them into the plug-in keys key store signer certificate into the signer certificate side so that he has those referenced when he gets the personal certificate. So you can move to slide seven. And I put a link here. This is a link for the details on how to go about, you know, it gives some screen captures of the WAS console, where to get to the key store and where to get to the trust store and pull those files out. And once you've pulled those files out, you'll then go into the plugin section of the admin console and push that new updated plugin key.kdb file down to your managed IHS web server. And if you're not managed, then you would copy it out and then sneaker net it down and add it to the IHS web server. Go to slide eight. So one difference I thought I would bring up here, because I think the question might come up, is that we also change behavior. In V7, V6, and V7, the plugin IHS, when it used to start, it may actually fail to bring up an HTTPS transport because of maybe the certificate wasn't right or whatever. And it would log that says, okay, I wasn't able to bring up my HTTPS transport, but I will downgrade and use the HTTP transport. This is a pretty safe bet because the session, again, is between the plugin and the WAS. There's no third party in the middle of any of that. But in V8, we decided that we should probably fail that and say the HTTPS was not able to bring it up. I need to log it and let you decide whether you want to go ahead and use it or go back and configure your HTTPS transport. So we added this custom property to go back to the old way of behaving in case people didn't want to be notified that it wasn't able to use HTTPS and just go ahead and use that insecure HTTP transport for that session. Keep in mind, if you're doing HTTPS, you may have already done your SSL offload from the client to IHS. So this is not an uncommon thing to say, I don't care from the plugin up because I've already verified it from the client down. So we gave them the custom property to be able to change that. We move to slide nine. So slide nine is question two. Question two was how to best determine a value for the server I/O setting in the plugin properties. Server I/O is one of the tunable parameters in the plugin. And there really is no one-size-fits-all type of value, which is why this question comes up a lot, because we do have some default values. But let me just first say what the server I/O timeout means is how long will the plugin wait for a response to come back from the back-end server or JVM? And, of course, the answer is it depends. It depends on what your JVM is doing. If it's CPU-intensive or scraping a lot of database or whatever, you might want a longer value than if you're not doing anything very CPU intensive. So I wanted to also mention it does not include the time to open the socket. The socket and connect and all that is in a separate timeout, connect timeout. So it simply means you've opened the connect to the back end, you've sent some kind of request, and how long should you wait for him to respond? And we have changed the defaults on that because, again, there really is no one-size-fits-all. back in V7, we had like a 60-second timer. We've upped that to like 900 seconds in V8. And before I move on, the other thing, so you have this range of things you want to fine-tune. But I wanted to also flag here, watch out for setting the server I/O timeout to zero. Zero means, in a plugin's point of view, I'll wait forever for the back end to respond. Of course, it doesn't really mean forever because there may be some system transport configuration, like TCP configuration, that will eventually quit as well. But that could be a long time, and that could hold up your thread a long time if you don't want to time out. So just be aware that setting it to zero is not necessarily a very good idea. Slide 10, please. Okay, so one of the best ways to tune this is to actually go into your IHS configuration, your hdbd.conf file, and add a percent %t or a percent %d log format. T is in seconds, and D is in microseconds. So it depends on, I guess, on how fussy you are for your performance and your time to respond. But you would add this log format and then let it run for a while on a normal day, a normal procedure, and some interval that you define as maybe worst-case scenario or something like that. Then go into those logs and take a look and see what's being logged as percent %t or percent %d is the complete round-trip interval that it takes to satisfy a request that IHS will log in the access log. And based on that time, that's probably a good, pretty good reference to take that time, add a few seconds to it, and then go back into your plugin and through the console, update that server IO timeout or send request receive timeout to be that plus maybe 10 seconds or so to give yourself a safe margin on what you expect to be the longest return time. So move to slide 11. So that first bullet just reiterates what I just said. Whatever you find out to be your longest time, add 10 seconds or so, and then update your server IO timeout for that value. And it's not called server IO timeout on the WAS admin console. So I threw this bullet in to say, if you're looking for it, it's under the application servers plugin properties, and it's actually a box called rewrite timeout in seconds. And that becomes the server IO timeout for the plugin property. Go to slide 12. Question 3, unrelated. How to manually exclude a node from the plugin file XML? If your node agent isn't up, or if your node agent isn't up, you don't want to take the time for plugin to choose that guy, go out and try to use him and find out he's not there. So you don't want to waste those cycles. So go ahead and turn to slide 13. There really is no method to do that on a node scope when a plugin configuration, but you can exclude particular JVMs or servers. So I guess my answer would be you would want to maybe pull out or exclude each JVM that you know to be part of that node if you're thinking in scope of node instead of scope of JVM. But the question really is more like per JVM or per server. The graceful way to do that, if the audience here is familiar with session affinity, you may not want to pull the rug out on a server that's already serving an ongoing request. So the graceful way to do that would be to set the JVM's weight to zero. And that just means that we won't send any new requests over that, but we'll let the existing affinity request run to completion. So that might be a graceful way to take the server out. Continue to slide 14. The other way to do it would be to actually remove that JVM from the primary list of servers. And for those that are familiar with the plugin config.xml, there's a primary list of servers within a cluster, and you could also have a secondary list that says, don't use the secondary unless all my primaries die. So you could go in there and take the JVMs that you want to quiesce or take out of the mix, remove them from the primary list. And that, again, is done over at the application in the WAS admin console for application plugin properties. It's called a server role, and it's primary or secondary. So you could remove it from the primary list. And the last resort would be to actually hand edit the plugin config XML and just remove those from the list. The caution there is that's a temporary fix, because if you automatic regenerate and repropagate your plugin XML, you're going to clobber any of the changes you might have just made. All right, move on to slide 15. Question 4 on login was one that Bob was going to address, so I'll hand it over to Bob now.
Okay. Question 4 on the screen, slide 15, says, how can I rotate the WebSphere plugin log?
Well, on Windows, you can't. But on Unix, I'm sorry, slide 16.
But on Unix, you can, using those three commands that are on the slide, some of the ways that we've recommended to customers is to incorporate those commands into some type of script and set up some kind of cron tab so that you can limit the rotate the plugin log. Something that's important to note is that, you know, if the plugin is a 32-bit plugin, there is a limitation of 2 gig. I believe in a 32-bit plugin, after the 2 gig limit, the plugin's going to stop loading, logging anyway, and that is a way we can get around and get more than 2 gig worth of logs on a 32-bit plugin. However, 64-bit plugins, which is all of V8 except for Windows, and so, two platforms in V7, we don't have this limitation. And in that case, it still may be worthwhile to rotate the plugin log for manageability purposes. So can we go to slide 17? Okay, question 5 here is, what is better, plugin round robin, load balancing, or random? And go to slide 18. What my first statement would be that both give an even distribution of new and non-affinity requests. Again, without going into it, but, you know, we'll probably touch on it through some other slides, the emphasis has to be on new and non-affinity requests. You know, the plugin balances those. It does not balance total requests. So some of the customer expectations may be looking at total requests is not an indication of a plugin unequally load balancing the requests. The plugin design is such that it's not a global plugin load balancing within the entire context of the web server. So the plugin load balancing is contained within each web server process. So, you know, that's, if you want to say it's a limitation, but the way to look at it is the plugin is not going to be globally load balancing all requests across all processes, all new requests and non-affinity across all processes. So now you can see where round robin, you know, may be best in a single processor environment, because if you have a single process, that's basically kind of a global handling of load balancing. And a general rule has been that if you're going to have multiple web server processes, that random load balancing may work better. Can we go to slide 19? And we'll touch on this later, but the proper way or a good way to review your plugin load balancing to your JVMs is using the plugin log stat log records, and we'll talk about that either in the next question or later on down. But that is a way that you yourself can judge whether or not the plugin is load balancing equally. We'll go to slide 20. So, I mean, here it is. That's the leading question. So we want to use the plugin log, specifically the stats log entry, to analyze the performance of the plugin load balancing. So can we go to slide 21? To do this, we need to talk about how we're going to get these stat log entries and talk about, you know, the contents of these log entries. So to get stat log entries, you have to change the log level in the plugin config XML to stats. And you can do that preferably through the admin console and generating the plugin and propagating the plugin. if you're sure that you're not going to be generating and propagating to the plugin and you won't be overriding your plugin config XML, you could, you know, make a hand edit change to the plugin config XML. So there, the specific log level, the stat log entries, as I indicated before, we're going to have to be looking at them from a process, per process basis and a per application server basis. But to actually talk to the contents of the entry, the there are four entries that are critical for the analysis. And the first one that I'm talking about in this slide is pending requests. Pending requests are the actual number of requests for which the plugin is waiting for a response for the app server. So this is a dynamic value, and it will go up or down. And it's preferably that the number of pending requests be zero, meaning that there's no, you know, within a it, it's preferably it'd be zero. And if you have more and more rising pending requests, that would be an indication that your JVM, your app server, is not being as responsive as it should be. The second category of requests that are logged in the stats log entry is failed requests. That's simply the cumulative number of failed requests over the duration of calculating and accumulating the stats log entries. Slide 22, please. The last two critical entries is the affinity request. The affinity request is the cumulative number of affinity requests for a specific application server in a specific web server process. These are all requests that have been routed to the application server based on the clone ID. For these requests, affinity requests, the plugin is bypassing load balancing. There's no load balancing algorithm involved when we're dealing with affinity requests. The next category is total requests, and again, that's the cumulative number of requests for a particular app server and web server. It's important to note that if you reload the plugin config XML any time during capturing the stat log entries, you'll lose your totals. You'll basically be starting off. And I say that because when we ask customers to give us documentation on this, we usually ask to run for a half a day or so to give a good indication of load on the plugin. So if you reload the plugin config XML at different intervals, we're not going to get a clear picture. Also, you know, stat log entries are just that. They're being cut after each request. But for the purposes of analysis, it's a little bit easier. We need to just go to the end of the log, and all we're interested in is the last stat entry for an app server on a process. So, you know, it makes it a little bit easy, but that's really all we need to look at. And I can't overemphasize that we have to analyze as many processes as exist for each app server. Let me go to slide 23. Okay. So I thought it'd be good to give an example of a stat log entry pulled from a plugin log. And again, you know, this is to show that we're pulling the process stat log entries. In this case, we have two processes and we have two app servers. So the two processes are Baker 0 and Fox 8, and we have Server 1 and Server 2. The way to read these is pretty intuitive. We have Server 1 has total requests of 637, affinity requests 632.
We don't have any pending requests, and we don't have any failed requests. And you can see likewise with Process Fox 8, we have similar results for Server 1 and Server 2. Let me go to the slide 24. So this is more what we're really trying to get to. So what can we derive information-wise from the stat log entries? So in this, what we've deduced is that Server 1 on process B0 handled 632 requests, 637 requests, 632 were affinity requests. So we're saying that the plugin load balanced 5 new or non-affinity requests. If you look at Server 2 on the same process, total requests 846, affinity requests 842, new requests, 4. A couple of things to point out is that this would be considered a good scenario. The plugin has evenly load balanced new and non-affinity requests. But you can see it certainly didn't load balance total requests. And the reason for that is Server 2 had more affinity requests. And that is a unconfigurable type of scenario. Each session has a different number of requests, and it's up to how intensive the user is in each session as to which server may have more affinity requests than another. So that's really all I have to say on this slide. You can see that Processor Fox 8 kind of shows the same type of scenario. Can we go to slide 25? Okay, question 7 is it true that changes to runtime weight do not require plugin generation and propagation? Follow-on question is, how long does it take before an update to the runtime weight is used? And then another follow-on, the runtime weight for a JVM was set to 0 to take it offline. However, new connections were still allowed. So hopefully in the next few slides we'll answer each of those questions. Can we go to slide 26? Just to make sure we're on the same page, this is the panel that I believe the question's referring to. You can see you have two cluster members here. You have a configured weight of 40 and 40 and a runtime weight of that's blank. And the reason why it's blank will be known based on the next slide. Can we go to slide 27? So the answer, the short and direct answer to the question is, for WebSphere version 7, there is no cluster runtime weights. They don't apply to WebSphere 7 plugin running on a web server. Now, you might wonder then, why does that exist in the panel we just looked at? And the reason is, starting in version 7, WASXD, ODR allows you to do that. And in version 8, we have the Intelligent Manager ODR allows you to do that. So I can see that that's a cause for confusion, and I'm not addressing how Intelligent Manager does it or how WASXD ODR does it. What I'm addressing is that's why the runtime property or input is there on the panel. But as we go to the next slide, I'll talk about the only way you can do that in version 7. So what I'm saying here is there are configured load balance weights that you can input from the panel, but and you can change them through the console, but you must generate and propagate the plugin config XML to the target web server to get them recognized in the runtime plugin. Go to slide 29. So this is a little bit of a warning that, you know, you can make a hand edit change to the plugin, but be advised that your change could be overwritten if there's a subsequent generate and propagate. I think this next piece addresses when. So if I did make a change and I did generate and propagate the plugin after making the appropriate change on the admin console, or even if I did make a hand-edited change to the plugin config XML on the web server, when would this be recognized? And to answer that, we have to talk a little bit about the refresh interval property of the plugin. It has a default value of 60 seconds, and basically it's the amount of time or an interval at which the plugin will check the timestamp of the plugin config XML. And if it finds that the timestamp has changed, then all plugin properties are reloaded. And that's emphasized there because there's any other change that's in the plugin config XML will be reloaded as well. Can we go to slide 30? Okay, I think we're trying to address the last part of the question, and I think Harold addressed it to some extent. But so the runtime weight of the JVM was set to zero to take it offline. However, new connections were still allowed. Well, I mean, we need to maybe define what new connections mean, but I can tell you what the design in the plugin is that with a load balance weight of zero, no new or non-affinity requests will be passed on to the app server. The JVM, based on the algorithm that exists, the app server will never be selected for a new non-affinity request. And as I said earlier, though, affinity requests bypass the algorithm for load balancing plugin requests. And so existing affinity requests with a clone ID will continue to be passed to the affinity server. And that may be, my suspicion is that, and obviously Socket Connects, that may be the point of confusion because activity will still consider going to the JVM until sessions expire. Let me go to slide 31. So this is just a summary of that, saying that no new requests will be sent, and as Harold indicated earlier, this is a graceful way to take an app server offline, but it's going to take some time for those sessions to expire. With slide 32.
And the question was about setting up, and Bob talked about this a lot, but maybe I can break it down further. The question was about implementing high availability with failover and sticky sessions. What plugin properties do I care about to set up that session affinity? So first thing I want to do is break down the concept of affinity and persistence. Affinity is a way of saying I want the plugin to pick the same backend server every time there's a request that comes in. Persistence is a way of, for the backend to say, we'll do a memory-to-memory check on each other when we're in the same cluster so that if I have to take over for you, we don't have to cause the customer to go back to square one or log back on or whatever. So I hope that's clear. And the question we want to talk about here is affinity. So that's from the plugin perspective. So the parameters that you're interested in for affinity, other than some of the tuning ones like server I/O, connect timeout, retry interval, which we can talk about in tuning if we want to, is simply going into the admin console and configuring the use of cookies. And you say, I want to use a cookie, and the default cookie is JSession ID. JSession ID is something that's going to be assigned by the backend server. So when we first generate the plugin, he gives me a piece of that JSession ID from my plugin config that I can use to decide who I'm going to send to, and that's called the clone ID. So each cluster in the clone, each server in the cluster has a unique clone ID. So when the first request comes through, and let's say I'm the first requester, there's no cookies involved yet, I'll go find out which server should I send it to, load balancing, what Bob just went through. I give it to that guy. That guy says, oh, there's no cookie here yet, so let me take it. I'll assign it a cookie. So he sends back the JSession ID. APENs a couple things to it, or prepens. He puts on a cache ID, a session ID identifier, and then the last part is that clone ID. Now, every request after that, it should come in with that cookie already attached. And now the plugin says, oh, I've already got a cookie here. I don't have to think about it. I'm just sending it right back to this server. So I think that's the question that was being asked, and I think that's the answer I was trying to give. Persistence really is an app server concept, and I don't really want to get into it here, but they just sort of change what they give me. Instead of a clone ID, they give me sort of what we call a table ID. What's the name of the table again?
Partition.
A partition table. And that's their way of saying, okay, these guys all belong to the same cluster, so anybody in this table can handle the request. So, and again, that's an app server concept, not really a plugin concept. I don't really care. I just know I've got a match. This is where I'm going. I send it over to that.
I'd like to take a moment to thank the panel of experts for answering the questions that we have pre-submitted. We would like to open this up to the live Q&A sessions. The first one comes from KK, and it says, can backup servers be configured from WebSphere side or DNGR console?
Yeah, it's done in the admin console. And I think if you go back to the screen, I don't remember which one it was, but there's the under the app server. So you pull up your app server, and there's plugin properties, and there's a server role box with a drop-down, and it's either primary or secondary.
It would most likely be under clusters.
Right. It only applies if you have a cluster, right? Because that's where you have this concept of multiple servers that have to have a role.
So we do have one phone question.
Okay.
Romeo, your line is open. You may ask your question.
Yeah. Hi. This is Rama Rao. My question is the plugin takes care of sending requests to WebSphere application server, but I have seen some scenarios where WebSphere application server, if the WebSphere application server is hung status, the WebSphere plugin could not able to recognize it in hung status, and it still sends the request to the hung instance. So in that situation, how we are going to make that plugin to identify this is in hung state, so I should not send a request to the hung instance, so that we could not lose any sessions to the user.
Right, and there's two tuning parameters that would address that. One first question is it the initial request, right? Do I have a socket already open to that guy that's hung, right? If I don't have a socket, the connect timeout is going to fail when I try to connect to it. So whatever you adjust that time, 5 seconds is our usual default, and you'll wait that long and say, okay, I can't get a socket to it. If you do have the socket and it hung and you're able to use that socket, that's the server I/O timeout that I talked about. You're going to send something over there, and if it's hung, he's probably eating it and he's not going to respond, and we'll wait for the server I/O timer to pop. And the server I/O timer pop tells us how to behave, right? For example, positive number says you can try it again, refresh interval, or not refresh, it says try it again. A negative timer says mark him down right away and fail over to the next guy. And then within the retry interval, you'll come back and retry those servers that had been marked down.
And this is Bob. I'm not sure where you were headed with this, but I just want to add this piece to it. In a scenario like that, some of the concerns I've seen in PMRs are that not just the one single request thread in IHS or the web server is caught up, but that's an easy way that you can end up getting the max clients in a heavy loaded environment. And one way that you can protect the web server from a specific non-responsive app server in a cluster is to use max connections. And I'm saying this, most customers set max connections to -1. That's a safe way to not under-throttle access to the JVM. But if it's absolutely important for you to ensure that the web server doesn't get caught up with all its threads on a hung JVM, you can seriously look at configuring a max connections value, and what that will do is it will limit the maximum number of simultaneous connections to a non-responsive JVM so that the IHS thread pool isn't exhausted.
Does that answer your question?
Yep.
And then we will go to the next one that's in our web conference. This one is also from KK. How can we ensure that backup server setting is not overwritten by automatic generation and propagation of the plugin file?
This is Bob. I guess if the backup servers are set through the WebSphere admin console and not made through a hand edit change to the plugin config XML, you shouldn't have any override of the backup servers.
We'll go on to the next question. This one came from VJ. Plugin is sending a request to bad server. Let's say the WAS server is hung or WAS server lost connection to DB server. How does the plugin determine and make sure it's not sending requests to bad WAS server? The plugin will mark the JVM down only when WAS JVM is down, but if WAS JVM is hung, the plugin is sending the request to bad JVM, and we want to avoid the situation.
I think that's addressed through server I/O timeout. The JVM can be up and running and be non-responsive, and the server I/O timeout is a way not to needlessly spin requests. There is a retry interval that it is defaulted, I believe, to 60 seconds. That's the amount of time the plugin will leave the app server marked down. There will be some churn every 60 seconds as long as the JVM is not healed. But the other way to look at it is if it's a small glitch, 60 seconds may be an ample period of time to wait before resuming activity back to the JVM. So those are the tunable values that you would look at: the retry interval in the plugin, the server I/O. And one more thing is that server I/O, if set, I forget, negative or positive, you may have it set incorrectly to where there is no markdown. And you do want a markdown if you have a, you may want a markdown if you have a misbehaved JVM. But then again, maybe you don't, because if the request is tied to a database, back-end database call, the next request may very well be okay. So, but just know that server I/O timeout can be set such that it fires and it handles that particular request, killing the request, but you can leave the app server marked up or down.
Next question comes from Joe. Using 8.5.5 to generate and propagate the plugin config using the command line, are genplug config.sh with propagate yes for local and genplug in config.sh followed by propagate plug in config.py for remote propagation recommended?
I think that it's the same six, half dozen, or another. I mean, it's not recommended or not recommended, right? You can either do the console. I think the console is probably just issuing the same set of commands under the covers. I'm not sure what the question was geared towards. Are they having problems generating those commands, or?
And
the end result's the same.
Well, and one comment I'd add is generate plugin cfg.sh without any arguments infers that we're generating a global plugin config XML, and that's not really recommended. There are issues with, you know, global plugin config. Some of them have been fixed a little bit in V8, but the preferred way to generate the plugin is, you know, with an associated web server definition. I'm not sure what the PY, other than that's a script. I'm not familiar with the script. Send an email if if you need me to look into it more, then I can look into the script.
And just for that, to remind everybody, that the email address for the speakers are on slide 3. So the next question is from Raphael, but I think we answered that one already. The next one is, it says, "Hi, Harold. Does this same link work for WAS 8? Is that?
Yeah, that, the link I sent out in the chat was just so you could see where some of these plug-in parameters are when you go through the when you're navigating through the admin console.
Another question from KK. Can load balance wait for clone ID be configured from WebSphere console?
Yes.
I would just add, I'm a little bit confused. Load balance wait is what the plugin uses for plugin distribution, but the clone ID is used for affinity. And there is a way to manually set the clone ID. The clone ID, in my experience, is generated as a result of enabling J session cookies. But there is a manual way to specify a clone ID in the admin console. And if you want to know more, send me an email. I think I can dig up some information that I have on that.
Well, I think if you're simply asking, the weight of zero, by the way, at config time is just a starting point. And at some point, the plugin's going to adjust the weight, adjust the weight, adjust the weight based on his load balancing. And what I might have confused you was when someone asked the question, how do I take him out of the mix? And what I meant was you could actually go into the runtime tab and set it to zero and sort of force the plugin algorithm to say, oh, this guy's out of the mix, right, which is what I meant by the intent.
The next question was from Raphael. Why we need to use get DWLMT table in the M2M replication, is it needed if the session is persistent over other mechanisms? Our case is extreme scale.
Yeah, it is required, but again, it's the scheme and the, if you want to know more about the difference between a partition table versus a clone, I think you need to address that to the application server team. Go ahead.
This is Bob. My understanding of the get DW LMT table for the plugin was a while back, using partition tables, there was a scenario where a new process was spun off in the plugin, and so the process did not have any of the existing partition IDs in it. And so what happened is it was a little bit of a rare timing scenario where the new process was spun off and the partition IDs were not loaded, so the plugin failed to match on any partition IDs because it didn't know about it. So this was in an APAR quite some time ago, and it's needed, but you can probably run a while and maybe not hit it. But it's usually a critical thing that we look at to make sure that that's set, because it's a difficult bug to go through. And like I said, it's a timing thing where on the plugin side, he's got a new process and he'll fail a request and we won't know why. And the key is that it's a new process and that flag tells it to make sure you load the partition ID before you take on any more requests when the plugin starts a new process.
The next question here is Nayase. It says, please expand MAX connection dependency to HTTP process since MAX connection is specific to each HTTP server process.
Yep, okay. All right. First I'll say there's a difference between MAX clients and MAX connections. MAX clients is what you reach when IHS has no more threads. So if you have 6,000 threads and IHS has a load such that all 6,000 threads simultaneously are busy, that's MAX clients for IHS. MAX connections is a plugin property that works within the IHS thread pool. The first point is max connections is on a per server, per process basis. So important is if I say max connections is 5, that's not 5 simultaneous connections. That means 5 times the number of IHS processes. So if I have 5 IHS processes and I have 5 set for my max connections to JVM1, it means 5 times 5, I'm allowed 25 simultaneous connections to JVM1. IHS could have 6,000 free threads, but that is how max connections can underthrottle access to a JVM. So it's important to tune this with a lot of thought and planning. So that's kind of it, and it's per process. So whatever it is, you have to multiply it times per process, and it's per bit JVM. And that's where the benefit is that, I'll say it again, is if you have a misbehaved JVM, you're going to limit thread usage to it. Hopefully that addressed additional concerns.
We have a question from Lakesh. Your line is open.
Yeah, hi. This is Lakesh. The question I have is, we have a number of applications running on WAS 855, and let's say we have like 40 clusters in the cell with 3 nodes. Let's say if the application has been deployed, and that application gets regenerated as part of the gen plugin and propagate automatically every 1 minute or part of the during deployment. So when the deployment happened, I can see not only the plug gen is happening for that application, but also for all the applications that are deployed on all the clusters in that cell, which is a lot of traffic, you know, I/O region and plug-in and copying over all the servers on the nodes. So as for IBM, it says that all I'm trying to understand, is there a way that or any because there is a lot of IO going around when one like all the other apps gets propagated as part of it.
Okay. I think there's some of it chopped near the end, but I think I understand the question is that you have a scenario where you make a single deployment change to a single app and you have a pretty complicated environment with both JVMs, clusters, and multiple numerous applications, and your concern is that the plugin is going through the same generate process, even though the only change is to one deployed app?
All right.
Yeah. From a service perspective, I mean, I've had a, you know, a note discussion with Level 3 about that. And right now there's nothing in the plan to make that change. The only way that would happen is to submit some type of, I don't know what we call them anymore, request for design change, is to go through that process. And there is a link somewhere, and if you need to get it, I can get it to you. But I can tell you that right now that nothing I know about is being addressed, and it's not necessary. It's not considered a bug. And from I'm not a developer, but there may very well be very good reasons why it's going through that exhaustive process.
Yeah.
They may have tried it, and they may have experienced issues.
Okay. Can you send that link? I just wanted to see because as our environment is growing, so this is pretty I/O intensive,
yeah.
And also CPU.
Yeah.
So
I you may have been the one to open the PMR, but we had a PMR with that. So you need to send me an email for me to get you that link.
Sure, I can paste it in the chat.
Okay. Oh well, can you send me an email? The email's on the it's brichter@us.ibm.
They're on slide 3. That's in the web conference. Can you see his email address there?
Yeah, I got it. Somebody, is there an email or is that a link?
That's an email. Brichter, R-I-C-H-T-E-R, @us.ibm.com.
Okay. I had one more question.
Okay.
The question I have is with the GS kit, say if I have a WAS 7 HTTP and plugin and I wanted to work with app servers V855, and of course we are doing it right now and we are entitled for that. And my question is the GSK kit is fully supported in that scenario for the six pack level that I have 70031 going against 8553 at the app server?
So you have a 7 something plugin going to WAS 8?
5, yes.
But why do you mention GSKIT, I guess? Oh, I see. You're talking about the use insecure equal true or false?
Yeah, I was looking in that context from the security point of view. That is true.
There's an APAR that addresses it for V7. You're at 7 what?
70031.
I don't think that's there. So depends on how you look at it. The good news is you're under the old rules where that's not being strictly enforced, and the new rules where it's more strictly enforced is at some point after that. I don't have the service level off the top of my head, but I don't think it's 70031.
Oh, okay. So is that expected to come later in the next fix packs in WAS 7 plugin?
You know, if you send me an email, I can answer that.
Yeah.
Okay, sure.
I know there's an APAR, but I don't know the APAR number, but I remember reading it.
Okay, sure. That's all I have.
Okay, we have some more questions in the group chat. This one is from Asim. Any advantage to using WAS plugin over a physical load balancer, F5, since the physical LB can do the same as WAS plugin?
Yeah, that's a question of support. We only support the plugin in front of the WAS server, so.
I mean, if they don't get failover, right. You know, you don't have some of those tunable values. If the load balancer is going to handle, the spraying appropriately.
We do have some proprietary headers that are passed back and forth between the plugin and the WAS. And, of course, we can't speak to what the F5 offers.
But it's being used that way.
Usually people put an F5 to spray to an IHS plugin. They'll have a set of web servers instead of going directly to the app servers.
And then the next question from Nimish. There is an option, extended handshake, to check whether JVM is running in web server plugin properties. Is it something can be used to isolate hung JVM so the web server doesn't send any new requests or to solely depend on server I/O and connection timeout for failing over?
Neither me nor Harold's familiar with extended handshake. Not sure if that might be an ODR. V8 thing, but if you want to send an email with some release specific, we could look into it. It's just neither one of us have heard of it.
Next question is from RH. When I try to add a new web server node, it automatically maps on all applications on my cell. Why is that so?
The reason for that is that way you don't have to individually go in and map them by hand, because if the default is map all, and it's an option, you have a choice, you could specify none. None is not the default. Map all is, and the reason is most people found it more convenient to have that taken care of, considering that Many of the 404 type problems that we have are usually due to the application server and the application being mapped, but the web server is left out. And also add, if you do go in and deploy an app, I believe the second or the third panel will by default pick the app server, but it will not pick the web server by default. So
it was designed that way to map all to fill a hole kind of that was there because deployment of the app was usually non-inclusive of the web server. So it's one of those things that you may not like them all being mapped. Someone else may. The option is none. Without going through the panel being even more complicated by making you go through a list of apps to click on, it's then left up to you to map them on your own using application map modules, module mapping.
And RH has a follow-up question. Do you know where to specify that property?
Maybe he means that option.
All is.
The option. Depending upon how you create a web server, if you do it through the admin console GUI, it's on the bottom of the panel. If you do it through the generated scripts, if you have like a create web server one script, if you go to the bottom of that script or, you know, the second or third to last line, it's a very, very long line. That's the actual command that has the arguments. And if you scroll through that, you may see mapped all. And if you don't, it means somehow it's taking the default. But those are the options. It's on the command itself that would be in that script, or through the console, you would say none. And again, if you need a little bit more direction, send me an email and send me the script or whatever you're using to create it.
We do not have any questions at this time.
At this point, I'd like to pass control back to Bob for a summary of today's session. Bob?
Yes, I mean, just a quick summary to talk about what we went through today. We talked about plugin SSL setup, plugin properties, specifically server I/O timeout, plugin log rotation. We talked about affinity, session affinity, stat log records. We went through to see how we could gather information from them, and we talked about plugin load balancing.
Thank you, Bob, for a great summary. I want to thank everyone for participating today. And at this time, we will conclude the Ask the Expert session. And a sincere thank you to our panel of experts for presenting today. You all have a great day.